Hello and welcome to the RI Science Podcast. This is the first ever episode of our mini-series where we interview PhD students to find out more about what they research and how they got there. I'm Charlotte Collingwood, and when I'm not working on my own PhD in computational neuroscience, I'm an intern with the digital team at the RI. I've managed to convince five of my friends to join me in the studio to tell me more about what they do as PhD students. Please do leave this episode a rating and a review to let us know what you think and help more people discover the podcast. In today's episode, we're discussing astrophysics. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Rohan. I'm a second year PhD student at the University of Oxford, and I'm studying galaxy evolution.
What is galaxy evolution?
So, well, starting from the beginning, galaxies are these big collections of stars, these big islands of stars in the universe. We live in one, it's called the Milky Way, but there are billions and trillions of these in the universe. And since these galaxies harbor life, it's where we evolved and came to be. It's really interesting to us to understand where galaxies like ours came from. So that's what I work on.
Galaxies can harbor life. Is that any galaxy or is it only ours?
We think so. People do work on this. There are lots of different conditions within galaxies that can influence life. For example, exploding stars aren't really good for life because they release lots of energy that can rip away atmospheres. So it's an ongoing question of research, but there's no reason to think why it's only our galaxy that could have life in it.
Cool. Which galaxy do you look at?
So I don't actually study the Milky Way in particular. There are people that do that, and they have a really cool sounding field called galactic archaeology.
So sci-fi.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. So what they do is if you assume the Milky Way was just by itself for all of existence, then you might assume all of the stars are very uniform. They kind of all orbit in the same direction. There's not too much chaos going on. But that isn't the case when we look at the motion of stars in the Milky Way. So what they're doing is they look at the motion of some stars that are different to the most of the stars. So we have some streams, some rivers of stars in the Milky Way that don't really behave the same way as others. And that kind of tells us that the galaxy may have undergone a merging with another galaxy. So before the Milky Way is the way it is today, it might have collided with something else before. So that's what they do. But my stuff works on more distant galaxies. So we call it extragalactic galaxy evolution.
Also very sci-fi.
Yeah. The names are very cool.
Yeah.
So what I do is, a lot of what I do relies on the fact that the speed of light is somewhat slow in the universe. So it has a finite travel speed. And what that means is if you look at something that's 4 light years away, you see the object as it was 4 years ago. Or if you look 1 million light years away, you see it as it was 1 million years ago. So I look for galaxies that are 13 billion light years away or further away. So we're looking at galaxies in the very early universe, when the universe was 10% of its current age.
Wow.
And so it's sort of like time travel, which is kind of cool. So I'm trying to work out the origins of the most massive galaxies in our universe.
How do you even start looking at the origin of a galaxy, though? Like, obviously the light is so old and so far away, but what are you actually doing with that light?
Yeah, so that's a great point that the light is so far away. And that means that these galaxies are really, really faint. There's barely any light coming from them. And so what you want to do is kind of like taking a picture of a dark area on your phone. You want to crank up the exposure time. And so we do that, but with telescopes. We point telescopes at a patch of sky for many nights of the year, and sometimes over many years, and get a really, really deep image of the night sky in one patch. And within that, we then look for very faint, small objects. So the idea is that you want to collect as much light as possible as you can from these, which isn't a whole lot in the first place, and then try and find those things. So they're very rare and small, and that's the whole kind of thrill of it.
So how does that translate to what you actually do in the lab? What do you do day to day?
So a lot of it is lots of coding. In fact, most of it's lots of coding. The first big step is actually preparing those big pictures of the sky. So we'll do a lot of work getting those ready for us to use for science.
Mm-hmm.
That involves removing background light from dust in the sky. But then we also want to detect objects within the image. So trying to extract objects and galaxies from the image. And once we've done that, then it's a bit of a needle in a haystack problem. We have to go through what is usually millions of objects in these images, and cut that down to maybe 20 final candidate galaxies. So we also have this image in different wavelengths of light. So we'll have a blue image, a green image, and a red image. And we know that these distant galaxies are usually very red. What happens is, as the universe expands, the light that's traveling from the galaxy to us gets stretched by this expansion. And it goes from a shorter wavelength, which is blue light, to a longer wavelength, which is red light. So we then do a bunch of essentially checks to make sure that the objects we filter through are very red, and some other things to do with the physics of galaxies. And hopefully after what felt like ages, in reality it was a few months actually, of checking and doing this, we end up with a handful of galaxy candidates. And we can't be sure that those are actually real galaxies because we only have some of the clues. It's kind of like we're a detective trying to solve a murder, but we don't have the full CCTV footage. We just have fingerprints of the crime scene. So we don't have a full picture of what this galaxy looks like, but we can be somewhat sure that it's actually a real galaxy very far away.
Right. So do you feel a bit like Sherlock when you're doing all of this stuff?
Yeah, kind of. It feels very investigative, and it's very cool when you are trying to solve a problem that doesn't have a clear solution.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly because in what I do, you can either find a very distant galaxy, but it can also be a nearby galaxy that just looks very similar, or a very small star in the Milky Way that also has similar colors. They're also very red. So you're trying to work out, okay, is it actually a real distant galaxy, or is it these things we don't care about that are closer by? Not that they're not interesting in their own right, but for me, they're a bit less interesting.
Yeah, it's not what your fancy title's all about.
Yeah, extragalactic is what I'm interested in.
Amazing. So how do you tell the difference between a star that's close and a galaxy that's really far away?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And kind of the whole point of my first paper, it's actually a really difficult problem. The main idea behind it is that we're studying the light curves behind these galaxies. And what that means is we're looking at the brightness of light as a function of wavelength. So how much red light is there, and then how much green light, and then how much blue light that we expect from these galaxies. And the problem is that distant galaxies and these nearby stars, they're called brown dwarfs. They're both very red. And what you're doing is you're taking an image of these objects in very narrow wavelength ranges. You don't have the full wavelength coverage. So it's like my crime scene analogy, where you don't have the full image of what's going on, but just some clues.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't be certain. Now, what always helps in a crime scene is having more evidence, more data. And this is exactly the thing that helps with us. So a lot of people will try to use what we call optical data. So this is images taken in the same wavelength of light that we see the world in. But you can also use infrared data, infrared imaging, which is wavelengths that we perceive as heat. These are longer wavelengths than red light, but they give you more information about the kind of light curves from these objects. And so that can give you a lot of insight into what these objects really are. So what I've been trying to do is incorporate this near-infrared data to get more evidence for what these objects really are. And it's been really helpful for us. We've been able to kind of disentangle stars from galaxies a bit better. So the whole point is that you need more evidence, as much evidence as possible. Otherwise, it is a very difficult task.
So in collecting more evidence, have you been using the JWST at all?
I have, but actually for a different project, not okay. For the project I was just describing. I'm using it to look at actually the shapes of galaxies. So my last project was actually just finding these galaxies and then measuring how many there are of them in a given volume, so density of the galaxies, and that gives us insight into galaxy evolution. But my next project has been looking at the actual shapes of galaxies, so trying to measure their sizes. And the reason that JWST is good for this is because it's in space. All the other telescopes I've been using are on the ground, and that means they have to look through the atmosphere. And the atmosphere is a huge, huge problem for us. Firstly, it is very turbulent. So when you look through it, it's like trying to look underwater from above the surface of the water. It's all very kind of blurry and moving very rapidly. So anything that's below the water is very difficult for you to see. You can see it, but you can't make out any fine details. It's the same for when we look at an object from the ground with a ground-based telescope.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we call seeing. It's a really weird term, but the seeing is bad from the ground. So objects look very blobby, and you can't really make out any structure of galaxies if you look at them. Or at least it's not as good as from space, where you don't have the atmosphere. And so everything is super sharp. For example, Hubble in space is only a couple of meters across, I think. But it has way better resolution than some of the biggest telescopes we have on the ground, which are up to 8 meters across. So JWST is, I think, 6 meters across. So it has some crazy resolution, and the pictures are stunning. So for example, there's one object I'm looking at which is, I think, 12 billion light years away, but you can see kind of spiral arms within it. So you can see that this galaxy is kind of it kind of looks like what we imagine the Milky Way to look like, except it's billions of light years away. So using space telescopes gives you a lot of more resolution, which is really useful for working on the shapes and structures of galaxies.
I bet. And obviously the black hole images have been so interesting to see. But what would you say is the wider impact on society of the work that you're doing?
Well, with astronomy, it's always a bit harder to see what the direct impacts are. It's not quite like, say, material science, where they're developing things that you're going to start using every day in your phone or your car. It's more the case that since the research is less directly applicable, that the technology that comes from it kind of trickles down into society. So a lot of the chips that exist in your phone, or a lot of materials used on the space shuttle, are now widely used every day. And so I think research for the sake of research is important for that reason, because it often leads to innovations that we might not necessarily see directly. But I don't think that's the main reason for all of this. I think the main impact is just because the night sky is such a fascinating entity that we've looked up at as a species for forever.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, every time I look up at the stars, I feel tiny and ponder my own existence. And I'm sure a lot of the people listening feel the same, or at least when they look up, feel inspired somehow. And so I think it's important to pursue these things because they're interesting, because we look up and can ask why. It's almost a duty for us to try and explore the universe that we live in.
Yeah, I can definitely say that I also feel that sometimes when I look at the sky. But I didn't end up studying astrophysics. So how did you get into this field?
Well, I think it started from a young age when my mum showed me. She used to get me books about space, and I remember seeing a picture of Jupiter and just being blown away that this massive thing just exists out there. And ever since then, I've tried to kind of read about it and take courses where I could at uni. And then, so I studied maths and physics at uni and tried to take astrophysics courses. And it wasn't really until my final year that I decided I could maybe do this as a career.
Mm-hmm.
I'd taken a project on the distant universe, and that kind of inspired me to look for PhDs that looked at distant galaxies. And so I kind of decided quite late on that I would try and pursue it. But I think I've always had a sort of simmering interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like lots of people have that as well. So,
do you have any advice for aspiring astrophysicists who might be thinking of doing a PhD themselves?
Yeah. Firstly, astrophysics is a very multidisciplinary field. We use physics from every sort of subfield that you can think of. So definitely try and get into as much as you can in general physics first. But then don't be discouraged if you're bad at something in particular. You might think you need a lot of maths, but lots of observational stuff is very coding based, and you can have opposite fields as well. So just try your best, I think, and pursue what you enjoy. But I also don't think you need to know from the offset when you're, say, like 10 that you want to do a PhD. I think it can be a very almost last minute decision. People can get into it any stage, really. They don't have to know from the start, which I think, for me, at least felt like a misconception that I had. So you can get into it at any point.
I think that's very good advice. I know I took a break before doing my PhD, and I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, it's smart.
So what do you enjoy most about doing a PhD?
I really like the freedom. It really feels like even though you have maybe a defined project, you're free to work on whatever aspect of that project that you want. No one's really telling you what to do. You don't have a boss to report to, except maybe your supervisors, but even then they're going to listen to what you want to do. And I think that's really special. It's also special in academia because later on, if you stay in academia, you have less freedom since you have to write grants and do other things, other responsibilities. So it really is quite a special time during your life, whether you stay in research or not, where you don't really have to listen to anyone but pursue what you want to do. And that can be a bit overwhelming. Sometimes I sit down and don't know what I'm going to do after lunch, but usually it's really freeing and inspiring.
Yeah, it's definitely a special kind of freedom you get with a PhD. So thank you so much for coming in. It's been really nice getting to know all the astrophysics facts. What is your one favorite fact that you've learned doing your PhD?
So you know how when something gets further away from you, it appears smaller? Mm-hmm. Its angular size gets smaller. It makes sense that the further something is, it kind of at the same rate gets smaller and smaller and smaller. This isn't the case in the universe because it's expanding, and so geometry is kind of weird. There's a distance in the universe after which things don't start getting smaller again. They actually appear a little bit bigger than they should. And this actually helps us to find distant galaxies. So the angular size doesn't continue diminishing out to extreme distances. It gets a little bit bigger. So that kind of messes with your intuition of the world around you. But that is the reality we live in. So
that's so weird. Do you know why that happened?
I think it's something to do with the fact that essentially what happens is, just say a galaxy is 8 billion light years away.
Mm-hmm.
The light that we see from that galaxy left 8 billion years ago. And back then, since the universe hadn't expanded as much, that galaxy was a lot closer and so would have appeared a lot bigger.
Right.
So when that light gets to us, it's a relic of light from 8 billion years ago when the universe was a smaller place and that galaxy was a lot closer and therefore had a bigger angular size on the sky. And so you're kind of seeing an imprint of that when you look at it.
That is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So the fingerprints in your crime scene are even bigger than you'd imagine.
Exactly, yeah, they're actually
giants a lot more detailed. Committed the crime.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, this has been so interesting. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this episode. Thanks again to Rohan Bharadwaj for coming in to talk to me. Please leave us a rating and a review to let us know what you thought and help more people discover the podcast. And if you want more science content, head to rigv.org for talks, live streams, blogs, and even more.